Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favor to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and today I've got two special guests with me, Alex Stiliano and Darren Murray. Gents, it's a real pleasure to be joined by you this morning. And maybe just some brief intros before we kind of dive into the conversation, really. So, Alex, Darren, whichever one of you want to start, brief background, who you are, what you're doing, we'll go from there.
Darren, you want to go first?
Yeah. Darren Murray is my name. I am Irish. I've been coaching in Ireland, England, and now Norway. Previous experiences would have been in youth football in Ireland and England with the FAI as a part-time coach, and at Morecambe Football Club as a youth development phase lead. And I'm now coaching in Norway as a women's first team assistant coach and player developer at a first division club called HamKam.
And just a little bit of information around myself. I'm quite privileged. I'm coming from a different multidisciplinary background. So I got performance analysis background, obviously, during my time in Scotland, doing a degree at RGU in Aberdeen. During the time, I did some analysis for the youth Scottish national teams throughout the 2016-17 season, working with 16s to 21s, both men's and women's, boys and girls. During the time, I was undertaking my my B license, and then as soon as I graduated, I moved down south to undertake sports science and performance coaching degree. I was in Southampton. At the time, I was privileged enough to work for Portsmouth Football Club, where I met one of the best coach educators that I've met. I've known myself, Sean O'Driscoll, which I thought Sean had a big influence over my my thinking tools and my overall coaching. And then as soon as I graduated from Portsmouth, I got my first full-time job at Stevenage Football Club, working as a pathway manager. Before I moved up north to get a job at Morecambe Football Club, Sleet Foundation phase, And then soon after, I got the job at Burnley Football Club as foundation phase lead until very recently. Also had some spells coaching for the likes of Ipswich Town and Colchester United as an academy part-time coach. But what I would say, my biggest influence myself was a Sean O'Driscoll at Portsmouth Football Club. That kind of triggered my curiosity around session design and delivery. And then obviously meeting Darren Murray, it was probably as good as my first exposure with Sean O'Driscoll, if not better, in terms of allowing me to explore a different route towards my own education. So that's why I recommended Darren, because he's going to add a lot of value to this discussion.
Awesome. Thank you for the intros, gents. Obviously, Alex, you know, we've been speaking on and off for a few years, and you know, in the lead up to this conversation in particular, we've been mulling over, right, you know, which direction this is going to go in, and then I'm sure there's going to be many different ways of which it can go, and it probably will go, you know. So, but something that kind of stood out to me around the build up to what we said we want to kind of explore here is around coaches having a range of experiences and how that might inform their education, their development. So I guess, you know, listening to both your journeys, it has been somewhat well traveled, which might be the polar opposite of what mine is, if you like. You know, briefly mentioned, obviously born and bred in London, kind of grew up here, and all my experiences have been pretty much in and around London. Completely different to your guys. So maybe just speak a little bit to that in terms of, you know, having those range of experiences from both your perspectives, and you know, one, how that's shaped your journeys, the influences that you've picked up along the way. And I know, you know, Alex, you talked there quite highly about Sean O'Driscoll and obviously the influence that Darren's had on you as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting just to kind of really, you know, dig deeper into that and try and unpack.
Yeah, I think, I think from my point of view, Yasser, and correct me if I'm wrong as well, because this is meant to be a discussion. Experiences themselves are not enough. It's not about the quantity of the experience as such, but the quality of the experience, the information that you gather from those experiences, because you can be a very experienced person having traveled the world, having seen a lot, but then how do you filter that information to evaluate the information that you gather, which information is good, which one I'm going to take to further my own development, to further my own coaching, and which information you're going to discard. You may not discard certain information. You may filter this bad information to then turn it into something good. So from my point of view, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a bad or good experience, you still learn from it. I would say my academic background, particularly the sports science degree that I did down south in Southampton, it was a life changer for me, as I soon became very curious to learn more about skill development, skill acquisition, and the principles underpinning it. I would spend endless hours and late nights in the library searching the bookshelves and reading, and I was very into it. Yeah. And then out of coincidence, I then went into Portsmouth to coach for Portsmouth Football Club, and my interactions with Sean and our discussions kind of connected those dots, and that kind of changed my way of thinking as to how we best optimize skill development. And then obviously meeting Darren a few months later, it kind of facilitated that even further. It made me a better coach. It's not so much what I would say is not so much about the quantity. Obviously, I had a lot of quantity of experiences in terms of academic and professional. I also coached abroad in the US. But it's about being reflective enough and curious enough to understand which information is good. What are you lacking as a coach, and what do you want to develop even further? Because if you're a fixed-minded person, no matter how much experience you've got, then you might struggle with that.
I think it's a challenge, though, isn't it? You know, it's conversations I'm having with coaches all the time around that reflective piece, but also, you know, if you just listen to what you're saying there, and obviously you landed in at Portsmouth, and you had you came into contact with Sean O'Driscoll, who was obviously, you know, seems quite influential for you. Not everyone gets that right, and sometimes it's, you know, it's where do you go to get that if it's not available to you in your kind of environment. And I think that's one of the challenges that I've observed from a coach development perspective in particular, that a lot of coaches, especially, you know, it's probably slightly different in that quote unquote elite environment, right? Because you've got more experienced people in those environments, typically speaking. But outside of that, coaches trying to build up and work towards that, you know, the challenge for a lot of them would be, well, how do I know I'm doing the right things? How do I know what right looks like or good looks like? And I think there is a bit of a conundrum for a lot of coaches, especially now the way coach education is shifted and coach development is, you know, started to shift, and it's very much around person-centered approach, whether that be focusing on the players or the coach themselves. And it's like, it's all well and good everyone having their own approach, but sometimes you also need that, you know, someone to hold a mirror up and say, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you noticed this? Have you noticed that? And just having that challenging or critical friend, if you like. But I guess it's difficult, right? Because, you know, even in my own experiences, I look back and I think to myself, I'm so glad I met this person when I did, or met that person when I did, because they actually helped me do these things that if I was left to my own devices, I probably wouldn't have even realised there was things I could work on. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that. And maybe yourself, Darren, if you've got any insights that you want to share.
I think Darren is he can talk about the references and the thinking tools that I think he instilled into myself. So I think Danny's a perfect person to answer this question.
First of all, on the you mentioned the range of experiences. The big takeaway from me, which I felt made me a much better coach, wasn't so much necessarily around what we're coaching, because the sport is the same. And the formats may change if you coach foundation phase or professional development phase, but the rules of the game are the same. The game, in theory, it doesn't change. However, the application of those references is essentially the art of coaching. And what I found is, you mentioned how you've been in London such a long time. That can be great, because you can be such an expert when it comes to external factors in London. From you being growing up there and working there, you'll have stuff in your unconscious brain that myself and Alex nowhere near will have. And a big takeaway for me is I found applications when I was coaching in Ireland and in England quite similar. However, because the culture, because Scandinavian culture is so different, I actually made a mistake quite early that I'm happy I made it early, which was copy and pasting, essentially, my coaching application from England with a Category 3 academy and bringing it to a B team or a first team in Norway, because the culture is so different. And there's really good parts of that too, because if you can take the best from different cultures, that only improves your toolkit so much. People from diverse backgrounds will have different ideas. And I think if you can take the good of everyone, you can become very good in terms of your toolkit of applying coaching theories. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, because you know, something that you both touched on there is about, you know, being able to reflect on those experiences and being able to, you know, in your case, make the mistake early. But I think part of that is within the mindset as well, right? In the fact that you've probably reflected on it, and it's something, you know, something might have happened that made you think, I have to reflect on this, what's gone wrong. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, it could be, right, can you put yourself into a frame of mind where you're constantly looking at the application of it and understanding that. And I often say to coaches, it's not about having necessarily a right and wrong approach, but there's a bunch of tools that we've got to our disposal.
Yeah,
obviously some will be more skilled in using some tools than others, but fundamentally you've got to ask yourself, what tool is required for the problem in front of me, mm-hmm. or the challenge in front of me, right? And it's that those learning experiences. So often, as I say to the coaches that I work with, from a coach development capacity, say, well, there's going to be things that you're going to want to take and adapt. There's going to be things that you're going to want to take and apply straight away. There's also going to be things that you think, actually, I really like the idea of that, but that's probably not quite right for me right now. But don't disregard anything is what I'm saying. So it's like, look at the experiences, think what you can pick it up from it, think about how it's going to change and adapt. But I do fundamentally agree with what you're saying as well. The content is never going to change. The game is the game. It's always been the same way. And like I said, it might have different formats. You might be working slightly different age groups, but the concept in terms of the content is very much, it is what it is. It's just how you are articulating that content to the, I guess, the end user, which in our cases is the players. And making sure that they understand the content, and it's not just offloading the content, but it's also that clarity and understanding for them to make sure that if they've actually got the content, you understand that they've picked up the content in the intended fashion, if that makes sense.
And there are so many external factors to consider. For example, all three of us may use the same periodization model, for example. But I'm coaching women's football, so my periodization will look much different to yours. Alex coaching under 13, under 14 boys, he only may be limited to half a pitch, for example. You may be coaching in an area where, well, like me, for example, where it's minus 15 degrees over the winter. So it's how you start with that quite objective model. And then you anticipate all these external factors to see how you can apply this in the best way possible. Your thoughts on that, Alex?
I totally agree with what both of you mentioned, and it's quite interesting because we, based on my experiences so far, we tend to be experts in either reinventing the wheel in football or copying what the champion does or what other people do.
Yes.
So what we need to be aware of is everyone's external factors are different. Your external factors, ESR down in London, are completely different due to the socioeconomic differences, or my external factors are different in a different part of the world, and then their manners are different, and therefore within our environments we have to cater for those differences. Now, going back to the first point I said about reinventing the wheel, what we tend to do sometimes in football is we change the game from what it is. And that's what we're going to go down to in a few minutes, trying to understand what sport are we coaching? What are the characteristics of the game? And make sure we use the philosophical starting point of the game as a starting point to guide everything else after that, i.e. the external factors. So one thing I learned myself, just to summarize what I just said, is don't change the game. Wherever you go, the game is the game. Don't change the game. However, be adaptable enough to apply what you're doing based on who you're dealing with. Like you said, Yassar, the player, that's an example. What does a player need, especially in younger ages? And it's more about the individual player, more than the team. However, we should not disregard the fact that the game of football is a team sport, because we go down the route of, we're coaching the individual as if it's an individual sport. No, you're coaching the individual to be able to be more effective within a team setting. That's what you're coaching. So
100%. And it's interesting you talk there in some of the stuff that you're saying, and really resonates with what I guess, if you like, preaching, I'm an advocate of, and I often say to coaches, look, the game doesn't care about how you want to play it. You're still going to have the same objectives. You might have a way that you want to play it, but the game will decide what your players should do in any given moment, right? So, for instance, you might want to be a team that plays out from the back, as an example, which 99% of the world seem to want to do at this point in time, right? But the bottom line is this. Is if we're giving you space in behind, that's what you should be trying to hit. That's the game. We're trying to score or stop you from scoring. And it's as simple as that. And I think at the moment that penny drops for a lot of coaches, everything changes.
Oh, yeah, massively.
That's the thing. In the first instance, right, a lot of coaches are too busy trying to play the game their way.
Yeah.
And they often miss the fact that sometimes, well, your way is a way of playing, and that's fine, but your way is a response to a problem.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Just on that, Yasar, since you mentioned it, let's try and create a reference point. Because you just mentioned it. What would you say the purpose of the game is? What's the ultimate aim of the game? What is it? What would you say?
Yeah, it's fundamentally about outscoring the opposition. If you strip it back, it's just making sure that you score more than you conceded. But obviously, there's two roles within that, right? It's the function of the opposition is to stop you from doing it, and your function is to try and do it, and vice versa in the transition of the moment.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think I know it may sound logical and stupid. Speaking about the aim of the game.
No, but it's fundamentally key, right? Because as soon as you lose sight of that, if you don't follow that,
exactly,
you then end up teaching something which is not the game.
Exactly. Because if we were to ask 100 people what's the aim of the game, do you think we'll get the same answer, or do you think we'll get a different answer? How many of those 100 people we ask do you think is going to give you the same answer? Scoring more goes on the opposition.
Surprisingly, I don't think a lot would say that or a version of that. I think a lot of them would say something along the lines of play the game the right way.
Which means absolutely nothing.
It means nothing. I agree.
Yeah.
I would turn that on another point, Alex, because I actually think out of the 100 people that you would ask, I think many people would say similar to what you say. But if you look at the point Yas said about there is a lot of space behind the opposing backline. Well, if we can progress the ball, because the situation allows us to play the ball to the number 9 behind the back line, so he's one-on-one with the keeper, that's what we should do. And then if the back line is lower, if there is no space behind the back line, okay, behind the midline, behind the front line, in front of the front line. But you can ask coaches that, and I think many will agree with you. But if you see many people, me included, many years ago, I was really poor for this. If you look at their training sessions, for me anyway, I can only speak for me, but that did not align with what I said, because if you don't use the objective as a game as a starting point, you may end up using these arbitrary conditions or constraints in games or your trainings, which actually may not be helping the player but hindering the player. And for example, you mentioned, yes, that if there is space behind the back line of the opposing team, well, that's the space the team should exploit. Mm-hmm. But
the practice doesn't represent that.
Exactly.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Exactly. And
just, I think additionally, just on that, it's often the practice doesn't even allow that space behind to even exist.
Exactly.
So the opportunity is not even there for them to recognize that that's a thing. But I think, it's the simplicity of understanding what the game's about that allows coaches to be more effective and impactful in their trainings, in their discussions and interaction with the players. And the way that I often try and explain it is, I go back to the children's story about the bear hunt. Remember that one? Going on a bear hunt, an obstacle gets put in the way. That's the opposition. The obstacle is in your way now. Obviously, in the story, the bear hunt, and talk about going over it, going around it, and going through it, or going under it and going through it. But the game is very different. It was very similar, in the fact that, well, instead of going under it, you can either go over it, you can go around it, or you can go through it. The bottom line is we're trying to get on that bear hunt. So if we're trying to get on the other side of that obstacle, how are we going to do it? Well, first we need to understand where the obstacle has been placed.
Yeah.
Is it been placed in front of us? Directly in front of us? Has it been placed with a bit of space away from us, or is it really deep away from us?
Mm.
And that will dictate, I guess, how we navigate ourselves around that obstacle. And I think if coaches can look at it through that lens, then you constantly go and get on the other side of the obstacle.
Yeah.
Is there space through it? If not, don't go through it. Is there space around it? If not, don't go around it. Is there space to go in behind? Well, one thing's for certain, they're never going to be able to protect all three.
Yeah.
it's about your ability to recognize and exploit what's on and then respond to that in that moment.
And understanding what you see, the cues, or you see the what, how is your position, position on the pitch.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just to go back on the previous point, just to make things clear for everyone listening as well. I'll paint a picture now. So imagine I'm the number number eight, on the ball by the semicircle around the halfway line of the pitch. And I'm facing forwards towards the opposing goal.
Say the formation, because the number as by itself doesn't give any context.
Let's say you're playing a 4-3-3 and I'm the number, the deep line playmaker, the bottom of the middle three, on the ball, facing forwards.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best thing I can do on the ball if I'm facing forwards? Philosophically speaking, don't think about, oh, this might happen, this might. Philosophically, what is the best thing that I could have done?
I think there's too many variables to kind of definitively say it's going to be one thing or the other. But I think fundamentally is, where can I progress the ball up the pitch? And that's the message I'd be giving to my players. One, if you're on the ball, can you commit the opposition in the first instance? Because if the opposition aren't committed, they're probably set and they're probably organised. You're right. Your sole objective is to try and disorganise the opposition to create opportunities to either penetrate through, around, over them, right?
Yeah.
So my first message to that player is, well, if there is a pass on straight away, play it.
Yeah.
If there's no pass on, can you drive with it to encourage opposition to step out of shape?
Imagine... You made a good point, Yasar, but I should have framed my question in a better way, because obviously it's my fault. I've asked not a so good question, and that's partly my fault. Imagine, exclude the opposition for now. Let's look at it from a philosophical point of view, zooming out. Mm-hmm. Let's imagine there's no opposition.
Yeah.
What's the best thing I could have done? I could do straight away. What's the best thing that could happen?
Theoretically speaking, play into the space behind where the defense will be.
Is there a better one, you think? Maybe
score from where you are and score.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. I know these may sound daft, but I'm just using the philosophical standpoint to get people to understand what the aim of football.
Sure.
If let's say the goalkeeper is edge of his box and I'm on the half line, I could just lob him.
Yeah,
just lob him. So then the question I'm gonna ask now is, why then in training sessions we are constrained, you have to complete 5 passes before you progress the ball? And
yeah, but I think
Does that influence the kid's perception to look forwards, or what if the goalkeeper is actually off his goal line? You know, things like that.
Well, I think there's a couple of things in there. It's a good point. It's something, but there's a few things to consider. I think the environment matters. So obviously, if you're working in, I guess, and it's not even the case for all environments in academy football, but space is obviously a constraint. Do you have the full picture? Do you have a full pitch to work on where you can actually see that picture that you're talking about? And then, you know, that's one aspect of it. But when you don't have that space, it's that challenge and the skill of the coach to try and create those game-like moments and game pictures when you might not necessarily have the pitch geography to work with. You might be constrained to, you've got a nice big space, but actually your space is long and narrow, rather than short and wide or whatever. You know what I mean? So I guess the dimensions of your areas are obviously going to play a part. Then other things. But I think fundamentally, I think where the breakdown for a lot of coaches is, they're losing sight of what the game is actually about. And it's not about how they want it to play. It's about what the objective of the game is. And
the thing
I always go back to is coaches understanding that. And the analogy I use is, look, at the end of the month, hopefully all three of us are going to receive a paycheck. But how often do we ask the employer where the money came from? Well, we don't really care, because the objective has been met. The money landed in my account. So if the players are able to find a solution to the problem that they've identified, aligned to the objective, which is to ultimately outscore the opposition or stop the opposition from scoring, then why are we so fussed about how it's getting done? Now, yes, there is consideration for the fact that you want maybe an identity or a way to play potentially, but often when coaches are having conversations with me and they ask me, how would you want your team to play, I said, I don't have a playing style. I'm playing what's on. What's on. Right, play what's on. Like, if it's on to go forward and in behind, and let's do that. If the goalkeeper's off his line and we can lob him, let's do that. If we have to combine to get round players, let's do that. But if we can go, like, penetration is what it's all about. So when it comes to, like, you know, looking at the principles of play and things like that, I often say to coaches, you can't isolate the principles first and foremost. And the only principle that actually matters is penetration, and it's probably the only one that doesn't require anything else to exist. Because actually, like, quite rightly, like you said, if I'm the numbers, if I'm the deep line central midfield player at the edge of the center circle and the goalkeeper's off his line, I don't need anyone to create space for me. That goalkeeper's off his line and I can clip it in. That's the option. I can still penetrate. Or on the flip side, I'm Diego Maradona, I'm going to take on 10 players. I don't need anyone else to create space for me. I'm just going to take the 10 players from. So 100%. Penetration ultimately should be the 100%. Number one message behind everything players are doing. And I think that's my observations. Yeah. The trick that coaches are maybe missing out on is that they're not directing players to penetrate.
And just to be clear, Yassar, just to be clear, because people will listen now and think, oh, that's very extreme. Yes, obviously, I'm using an extreme analogy. It's extreme. We're using the extreme that we're trying to paint a picture as to what the aim of the game is. Yeah, of course, we know that most of the times you won't be able to lob the keeper on the half line. You won't be able to play. Sometimes you may not be able to play behind. But
it's a filtering process, isn't it?
Of course. And you have to...
If that option is on, let's prioritise that one. If that option is not on, what's the next best one? What's the next best one? But ultimately, it's about working backwards from what the end goal is. So if we can't get it in the net, what are we going to do? Well, we're still going to try and shoot if it's on. So let's shoot if it's on. Right, it hasn't gone in. So now if we can't score on the shot, what's the next thing that we coach for? Is the shot and the follow-up, right? If we can't get the follow-up and the shot in, well, what's next? Well, where can we put the ball in that's going to allow us to then get a shot? And so on and so forth. So you're kind of constantly working back to the point of where you are. And, you know, I remember for me, it's always, right, can you get it in behind? Right, if you can't get it in behind, can you get it into the feet of your centre-forward? If you can't get it into the feet of your centre-forward, you get it into the feet of the next highest player.
Yeah.
If you can't get it, and you just kind of gradually work your way back. But the critique of that is, well, that's direct football. Okay, but I'd rather get direct football that wins games than having a stat says I've got most possession. And I often give the example in your comparison of, like, you know, if you go back to Man United with Louis van Gaal, right, all these great possession stats, but you weren't penetrating.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the next misconception, because when we talk about directness, people perceive it as hoofball game. No, we're not talking about a hoofball game here. We're talking about a pass to number nine that is possible. It's not a 50-50 ball. Can you play it into your number nine's, let's say, into your number nine, into space and behind, running behind, or into feet, for instance? We're not talking about a hoofball game, just to clarify, because it might be perceived as, oh, we're trying to play direct.
Isn't it, Alex?
Yeah.
It's that perception of what direct football means. Like, I had a conversation with someone the other day, and I was saying to them, well, is it direct football if my team like to play a mid-block? We tend to win it in the middle third and we play it straight into the forward when we get it. Well, I would argue it is direct. But someone else would say, well, no, that's not direct, because in their minds, direct football means going from back to front quickly with one single pass. But actually, context is key. Where have I begun my possession of the ball? Because if my immediate thought process is, right, can I move it forward? I would consider that to be quite direct, but it might not be the perceptual thing of going long, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's important as well to, for the consensus of a player to recognize, if you play 1-4-3-3, and the right centre back is on the ball, the most direct pass, as direct as possible, would be to the number nine. But like you said before, yes, a lot of the time the number nine won't be on. Maybe the opposition play with a player in front of the nine.
Double pivot.
Just for example.
Yeah.
That would be as direct as possible, but that would not be the right decision to progress the ball to that player. The most direct player in that moment, for example, this hypothetical moment, it could be the right back, 10 meters, 15 meters to the right side. And by progressing the ball to that right back, and maybe now the right back could be the player to progress the ball, to have that progress line between the right back and the number nine. So I just think it's important that something I found when I was younger, I would go and do coach education courses or do books, and I would apply these references as nearly as an objective in itself, like absolute application, which isn't good because everything in life is relative, and you should only apply something as a solution to solve a problem, not as a tick box exercise as an objective in itself. So I guess relatively speaking there, as direct as possible is some to some player in the front line, but as indirect as necessary, maybe to a player 10, 15 meters wide. And it's like you said, we go through that same principle again. If we can't score, can we exploit the space behind the back line? No. Can we exploit the space behind the midline of the opposing team? Boom. And it's just, hopefully, and again, I speak for myself as a younger coach, where I used to talk a lot to the players. And a lot of my coaching was done through conversations rather than situations. Because you would hope that your training sessions, you were designing situations where you create these problems, where you train it so much during the week that it comes to match day and it's like, boom, straight away, unconsciously, like a reflex.
Yeah. Mm. It's a real key thing on that, Darren, is that, you know, I think at least I just want to throw a consideration out there for coaches is when they're listening to that. That doesn't mean go and play games, but design games which create game-like moments. Design practices which create game-like moments. And sometimes it might be, you know, linking that to how you want your team to play. What are the moments that you want your team to play? And based on how you want your team to play, what are the moments that you can foresee coming out? So as an example of that, you know, if I'm a team that wants to, I don't know, play counter-attacking football, okay, are you creating practices and are you creating, you know, are you using spaces in your practices which allow your team to play counter-attacking football? And are you setting the objectives aligned to that, or are you just letting them play however you want? And come back to what you said earlier, Darren. So, you know, is your practice aligning to what you want to see? So, you know, I use specific practices quite regularly, and I do explain to coaches, yeah, look, I'd rather work on specific moments that align to the way that I would envisage my team playing rather than work in generic moments which might exist anyway.
So much more repetition.
100%. And then the variability of that comes in understanding, actually, I want to play counter-attacking football, but actually now I've got to manage the practice and, you know, and set roles within the practice which might allow them to experience or centre forward. This is what it's going to look like when you're playing against Darren. So we can adapt the practice to marry that up and show you what it feels like to play against Darren and vice versa. Right, now the practice is going to, this concept of practice is the same. There's going to be a slightly different dynamic because now I want you to practice what it's going to look like against Alex.
Yeah.
And I think that variability in the context, but I think that you know, that does take time. It does take experience to kind of get to a point where you can observe and identify and relate that context to the practice. But I guess, you know, one of the conversations I kind of wanted to really unpack with you guys, you know, if there's a young coach listening to this, or a coach earlier in their years, or just a coach that wants to just develop this area for themselves, what would your advice be in terms of how they get there? Because I think there's a big gap at the moment in coaches not truly, one, understanding the game and the concept of the game, or rather understanding it, but choosing to ignore that over their own principles and the way that they want to play.
Yeah.
And then two, it's coaches only getting to a point where they're almost beat into submission and accepting that that's what comes first, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Darren, you want to go first?
Good question, first of all. I would split it into the what and the how. If you have a good starting point, if you are able to design situations that will provoke the desired behavior you're going after, just like you said around counterattacks, it's great if how you bring that practice to life is amazing. But the what, the starting point, what you're coaching is most important. What do I mean by that? Let's just use, for example, your counter-attacking situation. And if we use 11v11 as a start, it is best to use 11v11 as a starting point to have as much transfer to the game as possible. And you will have your own external factors, like you in academy football. I remember a lot. We were only still restricted to one quarter of a pitch, or for example, 14 players, or blah 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 blah. So the more realistic you can get that to 11v11 for a transfer, the better.
Just two seconds, because it's a really good point that you made there. But I think equally, it's also coaches understanding and recognizing that if your game is not 11v11, then base it on what it would look like at 9v9, 7v7, or whatever.
Very good.
Don't try and create 7v7 practice based on the 11v11 game.
Yes.
Just.
Yes. Your starting point, Darren, should be the format that they are teaching. If it's an under-9 coach, then it's 6v6. If it's an under-10.
Yes, good. I just think 11v11, just because that's the way I'm working at the moment. But it's a very good point. No, 100%. It's an extremely important point. The next stage, I would say, to that is the how. I'll go back to the what in a second, but something I learned a lot around my application is, number one, people with a lot of purposeful experience. So for example, in my old club down in Oslo Rua, the head coach had been the head coach of that first team for the last 27 years. And he will admit that his knowledge around coaching isn't as strong as other people in his staff. But how he deals with players, how he deals with staff is very, very good. Ex-professional players I've spoken to who have been in situations where they've played international games, Champions League games, Europa League games, they are very good at sniffing a dressing room, for example. The application of a reference, I have had so much learning from asking questions from people who have been in those situations, because I've not been in those situations. And I think the best way to learn about those situations is by being in them. But if you can't be in them, you just ask the best questions that you can possibly ask. So that's about the how. How I would say to improve your what is by taking the game as a starting point, whatever format you coach, and constantly studying, discussing in an objective manner. Because like we said earlier, the game is the same. The game isn't different Norway compared to England. The characteristics of the game are the same. So it's about keeping it as objective as possible. What would you add to that, Alex?
I'm just gonna carry on from where Darren left off, because I thought the first bit that you discussed is a bit irrelevant if you're a beginner. I think it's too advanced. I think that the second part, discussing about the objective of the game and the characters of the game, that's the relevant point for any young coach starting up. And that's where I'm gonna carry on from where he left off. What are the characteristics of the game? So that's the what, right? So we talked about the aim of the game is to try and score the quickest way and the most direct way possible. Would you say that's fair to say?
I'd say the most efficient way possible. I think direct suggests, again, depending on how people perceive it, probably direct would suggest it looks a certain way. Whereas I think the efficiency of it is probably the word I would use, but I get where you're coming from.
Okay, so yeah. So let's use that as one. Okay. Second, what else? What's the second characteristic of the game?
Well, you've got two opposition, or you've got two teams.
Opposition. Yeah, you go opposition. You go opposition. Three, what would you say, Darren?
Direction is key.
Direction.
There's two goals.
We just mentioned three things, four things now. Goals, the target. Four things. Now, if you go around any grassroots session on the park this afternoon, I guarantee. And by the way, these coaches got no bad intentions. No coach, I believe, got bad intentions. They all got good intentions. They want to help the players get better. Okay. How many sessions will you see opposition in? Goals, targets, a direction.
Yeah, but I think there's it's a really interesting point, and I completely agree with you. There's going to be a limited number of that, but I think historically there would be, but I think, you know, I was speaking to a colleague of mine, and the way he articulated the point was really, really good the other day, was that society's changed, and it will continue to change. If I go back to, you know, my childhood, growing up on the streets of London, not literally, but I think back about, you know, we talk a lot about street football and the benefits that that brought, and you know, the amount of free play that we got back then. I guess indirectly, did that influence what training looked like for athletes or youth players, in the sense of we're getting so much free play that actually when we're getting now coached in a organized environment, that actually might be about refinery. It might be about sharpening the skills and the techniques that we apply and adopt, because we're getting loads of opportunity outside of that to explore and play around with these different ways of working, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas now we're in a completely different space where that free play that we were once getting is now massively limited.
Of course.
Not in an organized setting, we're not getting it. So now should the emphasis actually now be, well, it's probably kind of flipped on its head, right? Go and do your technical work at home. Because when you come to training, this is your time to get free play and work and play within a team, or collaborate with teammates, so to speak. Because effectively, like I said, society's changed.
Something important what both of you speak about is there is going to be trade-offs in every single thing you do. I remember first coming into Norway here and designing games, position games. And something that's culturally massive here is they call it småbana, which is small set of games, 5v5 on a small pitch. There is some very, very clear, good benefits to small set of games, but there's also some trade-offs too. So, for example, if I'm a centre back in a 5v5, my brain is conditioned to only communicate with pass options 5-10 meters away. If I'm a centre back in a small sided game with big goals, I will probably take more shots in that training session than I will for the whole season in the 11v11 games. But you can't completely take that away from them, because it's so important within the culture. That's something I did. I made a mistake there. And there's many cultural aspects that you will lose in the long run. But I just think it's important for especially a young coach to completely zoom out, to completely...
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Anticipate every external factor, every option they have, whichever solutions they want to bring forward, and what are the consequences of those decisions. Because if you just play small sided games all season, you will become underdeveloped in some football actions like long passing and whatnot, or crossing. But if you completely take that away, you've disrupted a lot of the culture, a lot of the social norms. So I think it's extremely important to observe, reflect, and be conscious of the consequences of your decisions.
100%. I think just have something else to kind of throw in there that you touched on around a small sided games. I just want to challenge perceptions of that as well, is that don't assume a small sided game means that you have to play on small pitches.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
It's small sided, not small pitched game.
I was going to say that myself. Yeah.
Yeah, marrying up the pitch with the numbers, you know, is often what I guess a lot of us fall into the trap of. Okay, we've only got 5v5, so we're going to play in an area that's fit for 5v5.
Yeah,
essentially, right? But actually, in actual fact, like you said, there's trade-offs. You might still have the same numbers, work on a bigger pitch. Now you work it, now you're getting get different returns from it, right? Whether that be more dribbles, more long-distance passes, or like, you know, like quite right, you might use that small pitch, but actually you've got full 11-a-side goals still.
Yeah.
So I think it's playing around with the, you know, with the task and the constraints of the environment itself, to ensure that you're getting the returns that align to what you were expecting. So just wanted to throw that in there, and I think it's because I think it's a good point.
Can I just jump on that? Apologies, Darren. Just on what you just discussed with the small set of games and the size of the pitch. But before I go to that point, I'll go a step back. When I said characteristics, keeping the game relevant to the characteristics of the game, what I meant by that is, and it's a principle called representative learning design, which I learned a lot through my master's degree in Southampton, is over simplifying the game. If you're gonna play 6v6 on Sunday and you're working on a specific technical football action like passing, you may decide to do a 3-against-2 or a 4-against-2. It's a simplification of the 6v6, but that doesn't mean you're going to simplify to the point where you haven't got position, you haven't got direction, you haven't got an objective, I've got forwards, because that's oversimplification of the game, which then becomes something completely different to the game of football. So yes, you have to keep the characters of the game relevant to the game you're going to perform on a Sunday, and of course you have to simplify the game, i.e. small sided game, 4-against-2 or 3-against-1. But then you can still train, as you said, you start in bigger spaces depending on what you're trying to accomplish. So if my intention is to exploit space behind the back line, and I've witnessed this myself firsthand with Raymond last summer at Galatasaray Football Club, what he's done, he literally done a 4v2 in a big 11v11 pitch. He narrowed down the pitch to a very narrow pitch, but long box-to-box. And he was literally working on exploiting space behind the back line in a 4v2 or 5v3 situation. So although it was small sided format, the environment he created with the space created behind the back line, it encouraged the players to make forward runs behind the back line of the opposing team. So that doesn't mean that if you're simplifying the game to small sided, it doesn't mean you're gonna play in a small space. It just depends what outcomes you wanna get out of. But something that we need to be careful of when we train young players, especially from a young age, is to not oversimplify to the point where it does not look like the game. It does not look like football. There's no direction. 100%. There's no... So...
But I think the key thing beyond anything else, and you go back to the principles that you talk about, you know, you talked about it, the four things there. And I think the most important thing for me is direction. Because if it doesn't have that... And not multi-directional, but actually just directional in terms of back and forth. There's no... we can go anywhere with this. No, let's go back and forth, because that is the objective reference point in which that guides the player's intentions, right? And this is why, you know, I've got issues with certain practices like a rondo. Okay, people will argue that it's got these benefits, and but actually, the studies and the research would suggest otherwise. But that's a whole separate discussion. But the key thing being is, if you want players to be able to get an effective transfer, and linking it back to what you're saying, Alex, in terms of representative design, they have to contest with the variables that you're looking to, or they're going to be expected to contest with. That has to be present in the session. Now, it doesn't have to look exactly the same, but it has to be driven by the same context. And that fundamentally is the direction. Because if I don't have direction, if you use a rondo as an example, well, the reason why the rondo is not effective for the people in the middle in particular is they've got no objective reference point. They can't respond to the problem of a rondo in alignment to the principles of play. Because actually, wherever that ball moves, they're moving to stop the ball going in front of them and behind them. Whereas if I just say, right, actually, you know what? Same practice.
There's no orientation.
Gonna make it directional. So they don't know where they're defending. All they know is there's the ball, there's players around them, but they don't they can't come up with a strategy to stop that, because they don't know where the starting point is and where the end point is that you're trying to get to, because it could be anywhere. So then you just get a practice where the players are just moving on a merry-go-round, essentially.
Of course.
Whereas, there is also the very good points on the defending players, but also the attacking players. There is also many, many, many trade-offs. Like I said earlier, with the small-sided games in Norway, it's very much culturally. It's a cultural thing that is played on a small pitch, because the game is played on 120 meters, as we know. But we spoke earlier about the passing priorities. Objectively, philosophically, who were the best players to progress the ball to in that logical sequence. But if you look at a rondo, and we spoke about what is football and the consequences after that, in rondo, it's just keep ball. And you are just conditioning the brain of the player to just make eye contact 2 meters away, 3 meters away, 4 meters away. But in a game, if our centre-backs on the ball, we ideally, before they control the ball, we want them to have made eye contact with the number nine to see is that progress line to the number nine an option for us. But if we just do rondos, we condition their unconscious brain to just look locally, only look locally. We condition their body shape to just stay closed, because in rondo it's just everything's played in front. Like you said, there is no direction, so they don't have to turn and be as open as possible to play forward.
Yeah.
And I think...
And they also don't have to scan at the same time, because the player is always situated where they are, right?
Yeah. What I would say to Darren, just to give a bit of feedback, because we like giving feedback to each other. We're very good at that.
Be careful
not to introduce terms that the audience might not be aware of. So you mentioned unconscious brain, but the audience might not be aware of what is this unconscious brain, what is exactly. So what we mean by unconscious brain is the game of football. When you play a game on a Sunday, most of the football actions that you execute, they're unconsciously executed. You're not really, they're automatic. You execute them without really thinking, like.
Everything is unconscious.
Yeah.
Every decision is unconscious, yeah. Alex. When you go and brush your teeth in the morning, you make that decision, it's unconscious.
Yeah.
You will become conscious of 5%.
Correct.
Of your decisions. But everything in the brain starts at the level of unconscious.
And it's stored in the unconscious brain. So this is what Darren is saying. And as myself, as foundation phase coach, because I've coached foundation phase quite a few years, these are the years where you can, because you're dealing with kids who've got a bare brain, they've just started their journey, they've got a blank canvas, it's like a new laptop with no information on it, right? You can easily pollute the unconscious brain with good or with bad information, but you can easily influence it with good information, right? Because if, let's say, from a young age, from 7 years of age or 8 years of age, they do rondos, they do drills with no pressure, they don't have to scan, they don't have to look, they don't have to make eye contact with the furthest progress line, or then they reach the YDP age groups where their brain has been so much polluted with this information, and it's very difficult to clear the brain and undone the pollution and then install new information. Does it make sense? And that's why And that's why the young ages, that's where the brain is so sensitive to adaptation.
Valuable.
And if you don't condition it the right way from a young age, then it's very difficult later down the line to condition. It's like a dog, it's like a puppy. If you get a puppy, if you don't train the puppy to go to the toilet outside the house, then you're going to have a problem when the puppy becomes a dog, 3-4 years of age. And that's an analogy I use. And that's what I've just wanted to explain what unconscious brain is, because it's important that people understand. Most of our actions in real life are unconscious. When you drive, if you're that competent and you've been driving for years, you unconsciously drive. You only become conscious when a car, when a dog just jumps in front of you in the road, and then you go, oh, I'm conscious, because it's different. It's a different stimulus. So I just wanted to explain that, just to make sure everyone understands what unconscious brain means. Apologies for interrupting.
No.
I think it's a really good point. And again, I think it is just challenging perceptions, right? Because, you know, I think one of the things that gets covered, can be guilty of it in many respects, is we're trying to rush to the end goal very quickly. And, you know, if we link it back into what you were talking about earlier, Darren, in terms of that what and that how, something that, you know, that I was going to mention earlier, it was that, well, coaches don't even know what the hows are to even know where to go to look for them, if that makes sense. Right? Because sometimes you don't realize that this is what you need guidance, or this is what you need support with, or this is a thing. And, you know, you mentioned there that about the coach that you were referencing, you know, being in charge of a team for about 27 odd years, great at managing players, but is willing to accept that coaching is not his forte, if you like. And that's fine. And I think there's a power in accepting where your strengths lie. Mm-hmm. And I often say to coaches, like, the best thing that you can do as a coach, in my opinion, is start by understanding what you bring to the table and building your coaching craft off that.
Yeah.
So if your thing is developing relationships, center that.
Yeah.
Build everything around it. If your thing is you're the tactical guy, be that tactical guy. If your thing is I got no idea about coaching, but I can get everyone to think deeper, be that guy, right? And then build from there and understand where the gaps are and the things that you need to plug in around it might be. But I guess at the same time, if you don't know something exists, then how will you search for it? And this is the importance of, obviously, coming back to what we said earlier in terms of, you know, enriching yourself of a wide range of experiences. And I think that's probably... Again, you see, even in academy football, right, where some coaches have literally been stuck in one environment for like 15, 20, 25 years, and they've become accustomed to the culture of that environment. So when something else comes in, or, you know, it's closed-minded. There isn't a growth mindset around, right, let's, what can we take from this? What are the trade-offs? What can we pick up? What can we adopt and leave behind, if you like? There is a resistance to that, but equally that also comes in from a perspective of, in the build up to that point, what are we doing deliberately, intentionally to get those wide ranging experiences? And if they're not experiences that we're getting, what are we doing to search for additional insights from the external output, right? External source, sorry. So for instance, you know, we talk about mentors a lot in coaching. Mm-hmm. Where do we go to find a good mentor? What do we get mentoring in? Now, if this is, you know, finding a mentor 101, what's the first thing the coaches do? Well, he's been doing it for 20 years, so I'm going to go learn off him. Or he's got an A license, or he's got a B license, so they must know what they're doing. When in actual fact, when you work in the industry and you've been around it for, you know, for a little while, you quickly realize that it doesn't mean a lot, right? It's just a tick box in many respects. And it's just depending on who's been involved in your journey along the way, depending, because, you know, I'm sure you guys are similar. You probably know some coaches that are out there level one, level two, and actually they're excellent coaches in comparison to some coaches that might be sitting there with a bloody pro license.
Yeah, exactly.
Go on.
Yeah, so what I would say to that, Yasara, a good mentor is someone who is also willing to be mentor himself. I think I put it in a way that you have to digest what I said to understand what I'm saying. So, but I consider myself Darren to have been a mentor for me in the initial stages, and and he gave me a perception around how we should design sessions in a different way that I had known beforehand. But then at some point, I've kind of become a mentor to Darren, because it became a two-way street.
Yeah.
Because once the mentor that you meet like Darren installs in your brain objective references, right? Then myself, I can use those objective references to challenge what Darren is saying. Therefore, Darren is learning off myself. The biggest misconception around mentoring is I meet someone who we think he knows everything, right? And he's going to tell us everything. And you do the way I say, because I know better than you. I've been in the game for longer than you. And then every time you try and challenge back, you get the perception of, oh, it kind of hurt his ego. And if you ever come across a mentor that you believe is not open to be challenged himself, then he's probably not the right mentor for you. Because you have to find someone, which I don't like the word mentor myself. I think the mentor is kind of an old school sort of term. I think we kind of move from that now. We need to find someone that we can bounce off each other and challenge each other openly using objective tools and objective references, because there's no point me now discussing with you, Yas, or Darren through subjective viewpoints, because it leads to collateral damage. We'll end up like everyone expressing their opinions through subjective viewpoints, and then we haven't got a consensus in the end anyway for people to learn from. Whereas if we keep it objective, that's why we started with the aim of the game as a starting point. Everything we say, it should be objective, and nobody can challenge it unless we say the aim of football is to score in our own goal. That's not the aim of football, and then you can challenge it. I just use
as objective analogy as possible, I would say, because there's many stuff we say that's not one, because if it was only objective, it would be black and white. It would be right.
Yes.
And knowledge, if you look at a coach in 2025, we have got much more knowledge than the coach from 50 years ago, 1975. We now understand so much around periodization, perception, blah, 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 blah.
I would challenge that. I'd say there's a greater awareness of what exists, not necessarily the knowledge around it.
There's much more, how would I say this? There's much more research?
Possibly, yeah. So I think there's a greater awareness of what exists.
But it would definitely be more objective if there is more research, if it's been evidenced more.
I think if we're generalizing, yes.
More reliable.
I think the challenge will come from a standpoint of how many coaches are actually understanding the application aspect of it, though. So I think, you know, you might argue that, you know, the coaches 10, 15, 20 years ago, they might have had less objective references to go back to, but there was probably more knowledge coming through application and experience rather than just research, if that makes sense.
Whereas application, I feel
like now there's so much more information available to coaches.
Yeah.
They're just kind of taking a little bit of this, little bit of this. It's all kind of, I'd say it's a lot more surface now because it's more available to them, if that makes sense.
The application of knowledge, is subjective because everyone's environment is different, right? The application of knowledge is subjective. However, the knowledge itself should be objective or as objective as possible.
Yeah,
sure.
What tends to happen now, we tend to use a subjective knowledge starting point to then apply into subjective sort of environment. So then you go subjective times subjective and it becomes chaos. At least make it more objective by having the knowledge as objective as possible. Let's use the reference of what we discussed. Can we play forwards? If we can. Can we exploit space behind the back line? Exploit space behind the mid line? That's an objective starting point. And then I go, okay, in my own environment, is my number six capable of exploiting space behind the back line? Can he pass the ball behind the back line? He may not. And then we use the next best available option, which is exploit space behind the midline. So that's my subjective application. My players are not capable of kicking the ball that long. That's just an example. So, but what tends to happen, though, we use a subjective starting point, which then, of course, becomes chaos if we apply in a subjective environment. So if we can keep the starting point as objective as possible, using a philosophical starting point, and then applying it into an external situation, like your environment, yes, my environment, Dan's environment, at least we've got more of a chance to make the to evolve what we do on the pitch. And that's just how I see it myself.
I think you're spot on. I think that is one of the things that maybe the game in itself lacks a little bit, or at least recognition for it anyway, is that it's too many opinions that you know, to get to a point of agreed objective reference points is quite challenging. You know what I mean? In most walks of life, you have an objective reference point. In football, people seem to think there isn't one, but actually there is some objective reference points to kind of concur with, right? I.e., the game is about scoring and stopping the opposition from doing so. That is an objective reference point. And the moment you can accept, you know, and if you don't accept that, then, well, from the moment you don't accept it,
of course,
you don't entertain that. You're not coaching football anymore. You're coaching something else.
Of course.
Or a version of football, if that makes sense.
And can I pick on that, Yas? So then, why is there no scoring systems at training? Why are we not keeping scoring systems in training? If the objective of the game is to outscore the opposition, and I'm doing this more side of game, 3-2 against 1 or 3-2, why are we not imposing scoring systems? Because
I mean,
because that will influence their intentions as players.
I think we'd be generalizing by saying there isn't scoring systems in training. So I think we've got to be careful that to say that, you know, that a blanket response to everyone saying, you know, yeah, no, the people don't do it. But I think what we can, I guess, take from it is that the actions aligned to the outcome of, you know, scoring, outscoring the opposition are the things that should be more present rather than the scoring itself, if that makes sense. But equally, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think there is value in obviously keeping that score and maintaining those scoring systems in training. But I think it's the action, the process, rather than the outcome in that respect, and the intention of the process as an objective, which is probably more relevant, in my opinion, in the transfer of you know, skill and knowledge to the match day environment from training, if that makes sense.
I don't think it's necessarily down to like an opinion, but it's about what is best. So, for example, if we want to get, you go to the gym, you lift weights, you have something called a training effect. Your muscles break down, they get bigger. You can also say the same from a learning perspective, to have a learning effect. And the question is, are we going, what situations in our training sessions can we design to make this as transfer as possible to the game, to the game on Sunday? For example, if your team is playing in a stadium of 20,000 people, you will never in training ever be able to emulate that feeling of 10,000 people's seats lifting up. You will never, no matter how, you will never do it.
Even if you get the people there.
Yeah, exactly. But it's about as close as possible. And then it's about your processes and your thoughts. And I think that's what I really enjoy about coach development.
Yeah.
When people can critique each other's processes, this is my rationale, not so much down to I like this or I like that, but what can be better, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. I think just linked to that as well, you know, you used the word there, and you said it's about designing the session, or designing the situation rather. Again, I'll probably offer a slightly different lens on it. I'll say it's probably not about designing the situation, but identifying what situations you want to work on, because those those situations already exist. And it's about being able to identify which ones that you're going to prioritize that your players maybe need in these moments, right? And then the design comes.
Sorry, if I just go back to the step when we spoke about the what and the how. For example, your team may be very poor at transition to defend. They jog. Their speed of transitioning from attacking to defending is jogging. Some is even walking. So that is your starting point. And then you want to design a situation which will provoke the desired behavior, however you want to transition to defend, blah, 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 blah. But if you are in training sessions and you use three teams instead of two teams, if you have your centre midfielder who is the worst at transitioning from attacking to defending. If you don't even think about your situation, the situation you're trying to design, and you give him a floater, thirds, bib, he will never be forced to transition.
Mm.
Because he's always just attacking. He never has to transition.
And that's another.
And it sort of affects his decision making on what he does.
Exactly.
Of course.
And that can actually make the players worse.
Yes.
So we want something on Sunday. We want players to sprint and transition, blah, 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 blah. But then during the training week, and I've been guilty of this massively when I was younger, we've got three teams on the pitch. Yeah. We've got three different color bibs instead of two. So it's like, how is this going to have a training effect to make this player better on match day when it's not the game?
I think just linked to that, it's a really good point there, Darren. Sorry to cut you there, Alex. Go on.
Yeah. So I was going to say that's another aspect of how we train players that is traditionally being conditioned into coaches to then using their own session because a huge part of how we train players is tradition.
Mm.
Is the tradition... The traditional perception of how we should train. And floaters have always been incorporated into sessions. Now, if you look at it from a philosophical starting point, the floater does not play football. It plays a sport that looks like football. The floater will only attack, will never defend, right? And when sometimes you challenge that, they go, oh, but it will only be a floater for 5 minutes. I said, still, it's not a good enough answer because for 5 minutes, he's not playing football. And if he's a 9-year-old, you're conditioned going back to the unconscious brain, the blank canvas. You're conditioning the brain of a 9-year-old to think, I can only attack. I'm not going to defend.
I think also within that, it's also challenging the rationale for the coaches around why they use the floater. And in many cases, they'll say, well, we've got an odd number. Okay, fine, you've got an odd number. But actually, is the game odd numbered at certain points within certain knowledge?
Red card.
Yeah.
Your team get a red card.
Player's gone down injured or whatever that looks like.
10-11.
Yeah. So, you know, you're better off saying, well, he's not going to be a floater. He's going to play for this team and then we'll switch him to the other team in 2 minutes or something like that, rather than having it a freely transitional between both teams. Because I think it's a really good point. And I think even taking it back a step as well, it's like, you know, if you're going to think about the practice design and the game moments that you're creating for the players to experience within training, well, I guess the thing that I always say to coaches to think about is, well, if you want players to make decisions in your sessions, absolutely fine. But you have to ask yourself this. The decision that I'm asking or allowing them to make in my session, is that a decision that I will praise or critique when they get to match day?
Very good.
Okay. And if I'm going to critique it, then why am I allowing them to do it here?
Exactly. Exactly.
Right? If I want them to do it and I'm going to praise it, let them carry on. But at the same time, it's also recognizing the reason why they make that decision on match day should also now be present in the session.
Of course. Of course.
Because if that reason's not there, then they're probably not going to make it in the session.
Of course. And vice versa. Yeah, of course. And it's like asking little Billy, who plays as a floater on Monday afternoon, to counter press on a Sunday. And then the coach is on the sideline shouting at Billy, you just lost the ball. You got to work hard. Could I get back? A little Billy looks at the coach and goes, I've just been a floater on Monday all night. So, you know what I mean? If little Billy's a floater, then you've got no right to hold him accountable for not pressing, or not counter-pressing or tracking back.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? Can I say as well, I would never judge, and I am definitely not saying there is like one way of coaching, blah, 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 blah. I would never judge, for example, a coach for using a floater, but I would just ask the question. If I go back to what we said earlier about range of experiences, this is a big part of Norwegian football culture. They're big on rondos, they're big on small sided games, they're big on possession. And if a foreign coach came to Norway and they just stripped out all this stuff, that would be way too much overload for the players, too much too soon.
I think there's a trade-off, right? I think it's a balancing act. I don't think you have to strip it out, but how do you contextualize it to the game? How do you make that rondo more realistic to the game? How do you make it more transferable to what they're actually then going to be able to take forward? So I think it's the concept of the rondo. I think if you looked at it from a player's lens, the players would say, we like the rondo because it's social. We like the rondo because, more specifically, it's how it makes us feel as opposed to what we're doing, right? So I think, you know, and it's something I've been exploring for a little while, and I've been talking to a lot of coaches about it as well. Well, why do players ask you for a game when they come to training? Because they associate that game with a feeling, and that feeling is often fun, enjoyment, and all the other stuff that comes attached to that, right? But rather than looking at the vehicle that's bringing the feeling, look at the feeling and then ask yourself, where else can that be present? Can I bring the feeling to the other vehicles that we've got in our session, rather than relying on that one vehicle? Because what are you going to do when that vehicle's heading in the wrong direction to what you're actually trying to work on, but actually it's culturally what they're used to? Well, we have to now start to challenge that norm and create the feelings attached to the vehicle rather than utilize the vehicle itself, if that makes sense.
Of course, bang on. Yeah, totally. What I was going to add to that, my initial reflection of that was, why does that happen? And I think Darren spoke about unconscious brain for the player. But what about the unconscious brain of the coach? You've got a young coach who just started off his journey now. His brain is, he's got a bare brain in terms of his coach thinking tools. So his first few interactions with his coaching counterparts and mentors and education providers will influence his unconscious brain. It's like, it's the same thing that we just said about the player. And what you'll find these days, unconscious, sometimes coaches unconsciously make those decisions on a football pitch, I to stick a floater, because that's how they've been conditioned themselves.
Autopilot,
correct.
Not even thinking about it, just going through life.
I think it's that perception of what coaching looks like, and maybe, you know, where does that perception come from? It could be from their own experiences. It could be the fact that that's how they were coached as a player, or they're working with someone else who's more experienced, who might have an A license or whatever qualification, and that's how they do it. So they must know what they're doing, so I'm going to do it that way too. Or, you know, it's just lack of experience in understanding. It's less about how it looks, and it's more about the impact you're actually having, right? And it always takes me back to this one experience. Go for it, then.
No, sorry, you finished.
I was just going to say, it always takes me back to this one particular experience where I was working with a group of players, and probably like 6 months into me being there, the coach turned, you know, it was because I'm, as a coach, I'm not really fully hands-on in terms of, I'm not going to direct you, I'm not going to tell you must do this, you must do that, but I'm really considerate around how I bring your attention, your awareness to some of the things that might affect and impact your performance. Considerations. And then I'll guide and support you based on your perception of those considerations and variables. So it's a lot of collaborative conversations. But then a parent comes to me 6 months into the process and says, hey, the players are really improving here. You know, it's really good, but, and they're really enjoying it. But when are you going to start coaching? So it's even that challenge of, right, what does coaching look like to the players and parents, let alone the coach themselves?
This is a good starting point to a complete different topic, which we might not be able to explore today. So the coaching, the perception of coaching traditionally has been the coach talking to the players, right? Stop and I'll talk and I'll shoot. Coaching. That's the perception.
And
of
often
coaching.
Stop talk about the negatives.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So then my question, Yas, is coaching actually, is that the only way you can coach? Because you can still do situation coaching, and I will explain because I've introduced a new term, which I need to explain what situation coaching is. I am the coach of an under nines group, and I wanna and I want to provoke a behavior where the team that is building out, the team that's attacking in a 1-2-1-2 formation, it has to find the furthest away progress line as quickly as possible. That's my that's why I want to work with my team. So I need to create the situation of training where I'm naturally provoking it, this behavior, by how I'm shaping up the defending team, for instance, right? I may shape them up in a way where the progress line is not blocked. So the door is open. I'm not going to put a pivot player that is blocking the progress line to the number nine. That's just an example, right? and the situation I created would naturally provoke that behavior. I may not have to go and stop and coach, because coaching has been traditionally been perceived as I stop the training and I talk through everything that's going on. Whereas actually, there's a different way of doing it is designing the right situation, which is, by the way, probably the most difficult thing to do, that's going to provoke a behavior. A scenario game situation could be another. So something that I'm a big firm believer in myself is do scenario game situations of training last 20 minutes where a team is starting with a man up or a man down and one team is losing a game in a cup final and they go 5 minutes to turn the game round, right? And then naturally that situation will provoke direct play. I'm losing, I've got 5 minutes to score a game and just win the game, the cup final. I'm provoking an imaginary situation in a 9-year-old kid's brain where you're at Wembley, Manchester United against Manchester City, you're losing Man United, you've got 5 minutes to turn the game around, right? And I go, cup, see the cup on the dugout, whoever wins, you're going to lift the cup, right? So I'm provoking a situation where the team that's attacking, actually, kids are excited. I want to win this cup in the Wembley, right?
But it goes back to what I was saying, right? About creating the moments for the feelings to exist rather than the vehicle to be present itself, right? And as I think you're spot on, you know, we can probably spiral off into a whole other debate and conversation around this. But so, you know, I want to kind of, I'm conscious of time as well. So, you know, if we reflect back on all the things that we've talked about then, what were some of the key messages? In fact, let me ask you guys a question for yourselves first. What's been the most useful takeaways from the conversation we've had in the first instance? And then what's something that you hope would be a good challenge for coaches to think about off the back of the conversation we've had?
I think a key takeaway from my point of view is that once we sit down and actually think about the game from an objective point of view, we all come to consensus. Okay, we might speak with different terms. You might call it a sidewalk, yes, and I call it a pavement, right? But we're talking about the same thing, right? But we all got some sort of understanding of what the game actually is. And I think once we use it as a starting point, then we can't get it that wrong, can we? If we know what the game looks like and what's the objective of the game and the characteristics, yes, you'll get some things wrong, but you can't get it that wrong. And I think that's my key takeaway is for any young coach that's starting his journey now, try and think about, be autonomous with your thinking. Whatever you learn from people, that's fine, because you can learn a lot of things that you can take on board, but always question what you learn and actually, does it relate to the objective of the game? And if it doesn't, then is the information that you just learned actually helpful? Because if it doesn't relate to the objective of the game, then what are you going to do with that information? Are you going to use it, or are you going to keep on the right track yourself? So that's my key takeaway.
Third?
I think what you say about feelings is very interesting. I don't know the answer to this question that I'm going to say. So it's something that I'm toying with. Okay. I mentioned earlier about the center back in training that when they play small set of games on a small pitch, they are not doing relevant football actions. They're shooting instead of passing. However, you mentioned feelings earlier, which is linked to brain state. Okay. When I coach football fitness games, you would say a small-sided football fitness game with a centre back passing the ball into a mini goal.
What is fitness game? Can you explain?
Good point. I should have explained it earlier. Basically, you're trying to improve the football fitness abilities of the players for them to be able to play at a higher tempo or to be able to maintain a higher tempo. Okay? If you play smaller formats, 4v4, 4v3, 3v3, you put players in a situation where they are forced to perform more football actions per minute than 11v11. So if they normally do 3 football actions per minute in 11v11, well, they'll do 6, 7 in 4v4. And then hopefully you're hoping that this will overload them, stretch them, where when they go back into 11v11, they'll be able to play at a higher tempo, more football actions in the same period of time. So how does this link to the feelings part, what you said? When a player is training and there's big goals involved and there's 11v11, something I notice is there's a change in brain state. That feeling is much different. They are much more stimulated in that situation, shooting onto a keeper in a big goal compared to passing the ball into a mini goal. And that's where I think where it is so important, if you're working in youth football, if you're working in first team football, that you have these discussions after your training sessions and you understand the trade-offs. Because one season I may do application one, but in the next season with different external factors, I might do application two. And the outcome might be important to me, but from a coach development perspective, no one else really cares about my outcome. They want to know my processes and why I chose a certain thing.
It's interesting, just on that, Darren, I think it's really important to kind of highlight, and it's something I talk about a lot, is that relevance will drive engagement, right? And coming back to the, you know, attaching it to the feelings part, if the players don't understand why they're doing something, they will not apply themselves in a way that you intend them to do so, right? The players have to understand the relevance behind what they're doing. Now, they don't have to agree with it, but they have to accept the relevance of it. And once it becomes relevant to them, i.e., okay, you know, you gave a great example there, you know, the perceptions and the behaviors around how players might respond to passing into a goal versus shooting in a goal, passing in a small goal versus shooting against a goalkeeper. And the reality is, it's the role of the coach to then provide relevance and context as to why it is important for them to understand that we're playing into these small goals, because this is this moment in the game, if that makes sense.
Very good.
And there's more goals. They have to understand what do they represent.
That's my point.
Because the biggest misconception is there's more goals. I keep asking it's the same question. When I use there's more goals in my sessions, I always ask the players a question. What does it represent? It goes, it's to shoot. I said, no. And that's why I flip the goals now. You know, when you keep the goals, there's more goals upright, it looks like a shooting opportunity. When you flip them on the opposite side where it becomes lower, they're conditioned to pass it, because if you shoot it, you're not going to be able to accomplish your task. Yeah. So they have to condition the brain and the goal is a passing option, it's not a shot. The small goal is a pass, not a shot, which then allows them to link it to the game. Oh, it could be a number six dropping in. It could be a number nine dropping in. And that's when also people need to reference the apparatus that you use and why you're using. Now, just last point from me, Yas, we keep talking about constraint approach, which in his definition, if I hear constraint, means it's something that constrains or restricts a player, a rule, which is a bit misconception around what constraints is. I say it's situation coaching, is creating a situation with certain constraints, like sparring partners is a situation. If you put me up against the fastest player in the team, then that affords me with a different situation. It gives me a different solution than if you pair me up against a slower player. Then if you use bigger goals, that affords me to shoot, or if you use a smaller goal, that affords me to pass. It's a constraint. The situations, the scenario that you impose a training, like a team losing 1-0 in a cup final, that itself is a situation. So it's part of the constraints-led approach. However, we have to really get the coaches to think about not restricting the player to the point that you're making the players worse at football, for instance, because you could say, oh, you have to complete 5 passes before you progress to the next line. Actually, then if the furthest option is on and you have to complete 5 passes, essentially what you're doing, you are kind of making them worse at football by polluting their unconscious brain. So again, it's a different discussion, but it kind of links to session design as to what exactly constraints are and how we can use them effectively to then healthily condition their unconscious brain without you know, polluting the brains, basically.
You're spot on. And I think there's, you know, if, but it goes back to what I said earlier, right? If you're working on something in training, make sure that the decisions they're making in training are ones that you're going to look to praise on match day and not critique. And, you know, I guess the point for me, just to summarise on that, is be that don't get them doing something that you don't want to see them do on match day. Get to match day, they don't do what you now want to see them do on match day, and then you turn around and say to them, but we worked on this in training. Because you probably didn't.
Of course.
Confusing.
Of course.
And literally that.
Yeah, and I'm going to finish on the same page that I started. I don't think any coach has got bad intentions. And if there's any coach out there that's got bad intentions, he shouldn't be in the game. I think everyone's got good intentions. But how we influence those good intentions with what we feed their brains with on a daily basis will eventually make them better and hopefully make the players better, because the aim is to make the players better. That's the aim. So I think everyone's got good intentions. We just need to, I think, just have a more objective starting point. So are those good intentions turn into good outcomes on the pitch?
Definitely.
Darren?
Definitely.
No, I agree. I've nothing to add to that. Keep reflecting, keep critiquing, and keep making
mistakes,
and keep making thinking tools more reliable, you know?
100%, 100%. Darren, Alex, it's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Yas. Good discussion.
Thank you again for your time, boys.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.